Last week we had a guest speaker who broke the thought flow and the pattern of our series entitled The Fabric of Life. And it was a welcome disruption, because I think the word was in season. At this moment, it's incumbent on me just to bring greetings from Dr. Aker, who's back in his Brooklyn pulpit this morning. And he contacted me after midnight last night, and he says, please give greetings to Claremont Baptist Church. And then he said, I'm still buzzing from the service last week Sunday. And Claremont, you welcomed our guest speaker well. He said what so many people have said throughout this year, that one of the gifts that Claremont has got is a gift of welcome and fellowship. And this is what he said. I spent some time with him during this week. In fact, he was back here, I think, was it Thursday morning, Sue, or Wednesday morning? Can't quite remember, but it was at some point in the week we were back here. And on the way to the conference from here, we were chatting about church dynamics, and he said, you know, we've been dealing with this thing about race relations for about 400 years. And he says, I'm the pastor of the church in Brooklyn, the Baptist church there, and I'm there for 17 years. There's not been a single non-black person in our church in that 17 years. He says, I walk into your church at Claremont, being South Africa with the famed system of apartheid. And he says, and I get a vision of people who are fellowshipping together, who are worshiping together, who have coffee together. And he said, I came here to speak at a conference, not about these issues, but I came here to speak at a conference, and my goodness, didn't God bring me here to teach me something? And so we've got something to offer the world, Claremont Baptist. Let's continue, let's grow in all of these aspects. This morning is The Fabric of Life, Part 6. If I go any further, this is going to be like one of those bad franchise movies that are endless and endless. But I promise you, it's coming, the role of fabric is coming to an end quite soon. And today we're going to be looking at sexuality. And I promised you this in the previous sermon, if you would remember. And the last aspect that we looked at in the series, The Fabric of Life, was the issue of marriage, the institution of spending your life with a opposite sex partner for the rest of your life till death do you part. That was what we looked at. It secures society. It stabilizes society. And it also gives society a future. Now, those are all the societal benefits. There are great personal benefits as well. And amongst those is a conduit. It's an expression for your sexuality, which is marriage. So, I want to speak about sexuality in general today. And the first few points are going to be introductory points, but we're going to be looking at Genesis 25, 29 to 34. You can turn there in the meantime. And we're also going to be looking at Hebrews 12, 15 to 17. Now, as you turn there, you might be wondering, where is this pastor going with the passages that he has chosen? Because they don't have much to say about sexuality. Since I've got one shot at dealing with sexuality, and I covered it a little bit 2 weeks ago in Matthew chapter 19, I want to look at this from a slightly different perspective. And so this being a topical sermon, so to speak, I would want to have some expository value on it that is a little bit new, and you probably haven't thought of it this way before. I like doing that type of thing. And so I'm going to give you a biblical definition of sex and sexuality today that hopefully is going to encourage you. And if you've had some errant thinking on this issue, hopefully that can self-correct itself today. So Genesis 25, 29 to 34, I'm not going to read it. We'll read Hebrews 12, 15 to 17. But Genesis 25 is the story of Jacob and Esau, or Esau and Jacob. You know the story well. But what happens is, Esau is the man's man. And you always know a man's man by the quotient or the ratio of hair to skin. So by that definition, Ron is the manliest man in this church. And I am the least manliest man in this church. Yeah. I've been trying to grow a beard, Ronnie. It just doesn't want to happen. This is the furthest it goes. And so Esau is this man who likes hunting. He is physically strong. He smells like a man. I don't know what that means, but he smells like a man. He acts like a man. And his younger brother, although a man, does not have quite the same qualities and properties that the older brother has. He seems to be a little bit more of a schemer. He seems to be someone who doesn't look you straight in the eye, tell you exactly what he's thinking or where to get off. He'll tell you one thing, but be thinking and doing another. He's a bit shady. He's got beady eyes. Maybe a little bit dishonest, but sees it nothing more as an end or a means to an end. The respect between the two is not very mutual. I don't think Esau respected Jacob very much. And I think that whatever admiration there was from Jacob to Esau was a little bit overestimated and false. But the occasion comes where Esau goes out to hunt like he usually does. And he is out doing his thing, and in the process of hunting, gets extremely hungry and decides to come home. His brother Jacob has a pot of stew ready, perfectly spiced, wonderfully cooked, rare medium. And he makes a deal with his brother, and he says, Esau, I tell you what, you give me your first son's birthright, the blessing that daddy should be bestowing upon you, give it to me, and I'll give you the spot of food for you to consume. Esau, of course, makes the big mistake of trading something of great value for something that is of temporal value. Now, I don't care how great the food is, and trust me, I love food. All right. But I don't care if you're eating at a 5,000 rand a plate restaurant. For you to sell your future for a meal like that is just unwise. And this story can be applied on a number of levels to making temporal value decisions against eternity. On a lower level, micro level, it also teaches us that you do not want to sell out your future and your blessing and your legal or familial right for something as valueless as one plate of stew. It's a general principle that can be applied to life on a number of levels. Never accept a deal where your future is not going to benefit. The future is the mother of your present. And if you sacrifice tomorrow for today, your tomorrow will always look like today. And I want to ask you, just as a general challenge to you, what does your today look like? Are you happy with the lot in the areas of your life that make you up? Are you happy with it? Because if there are certain areas, like I am, by the way, I'm not happy with my weight. But if I continue to do the same thing in the same manner, I'm always going to weigh the amount that I weigh now, which is 82. Don't laugh, there's a little bit of Jacob in me. But if I don't change, if I don't re-strategize, get a new vision of a future, I will be selling my future for a plate of food today. In my case, that is literal. You got to change. If you are not happy with your today, tomorrow won't be any different unless you change your vision, change your strategy, and change your actions. That's a general application. But turn with me to Hebrews chapter 12, and let's see how the author of Hebrews applies the story of Jacob and Esau, Genesis 25, the latter part thereof. Listen to what he says. I'll be reading from verse 15. Well, let's read from verse 14. Make every effort to live in peace with all men and to be holy. For without holiness, no one will see the Lord. Verse 15. See to it that no one misses the grace of God and that no bitter root grows up to cause trouble and defile many. Then verse 16, see that no one is sexually or moral or immoral or is godless like Esau, who for a single meal sold his inheritance rights as the oldest son. Let's stop right there. And so Scripture equates sexual immorality, errant sexuality, a non-biblical view and practice of sexuality, in the same way that Esau sold his birthright out for a plate of food. And the spiritual battle for many decades now has been around the area of sexuality, hasn't it? Especially for Christians. But it's been so all over the world. And so I want to share with you just a few principles, and I'm going to give you two broad ideas right now that speak to sexuality. They don't necessarily come from this particular passage, but they do come from God's inerrant word. The first one is this, and if you're taking notes, you might want to take this down. That God is more interested in your sexuality and your pleasure than you are. Can I say that again? God is more interested in your sexuality and the pleasure that you might derive from the practice of that sexuality than you are. There is no one more interested. There is no one who has got more concern for your sexuality and the practice thereof than Jesus himself. The reason that God gives us boundaries, gives us spiritual laws that's supposed to inform our actions, is not because he is a killjoy. It's precisely the opposite. It's because he wants you to experience the greatest amount of joy possible within that blessing, that gift, that institution. You see, if I remove holiness, I remove health. If I remove holiness, which leads to health, I also remove pleasure. And so the quotient of pleasure that you will have within this earth and practice of your life in it is directly related to how holy you are, which means do you have the presence of God with you and are you obeying his precepts and his commands? Are you following the heart of Jesus in the practice of life and the pursuit of happiness? God is more interested in your sexuality than you are. The second overall overarching point that I'd like to make is that you won't die if you never ever have sex. You see, I know there's some of you, it's usually the younger folk, who think that all of life revolves around the practice of my sexuality. No, it doesn't. All of life revolves around Jesus. You dare not stand in this church or any other and say, all to Jesus I surrender except my sexuality. You dare not say, all I need is Jesus, when all you really want is a sexual partner. I want to tell you that your sexuality does not have to frame the agenda for the rest of your life. And so to all our single people, Paul says, the apostle, that if you brunt, if you are burning sexually, it is better to get married. Now, You need to understand the context of what he's saying. It's the same like in Matthew 19, where Jesus says, listen, the reason that Moses and God allowed you to get a divorce was because your hearts were hardened. And because there were people, women, in a patriarchal society on steroids that were marginalized. They didn't have access to education. They usually never had access to a firm economy. They couldn't participate in making money to sustain themselves properly. The only institution by which they would be protected and provided for would be by means of marriage. So there are a number of reasons, some of which I'm not stating right now. This is a sermon, not a lecture, that influenced the decision to do so. And so Paul's saying, in the context of you burning, having an uncontrollable sexual desire rather than sinning and giving it a vent that will lead to an unholy, unhealthy, and lack of pleasure in your life, I want you to rather get married and expend that energy in that context. But I want to tell you the truth. That you do not have to even get married if you can rest in Jesus. When I say get married, I mean get married for the sole purpose of having a sexual partner. Can you imagine? Let me use myself as an example. I'm a very romantic guy. I mean, any woman that is married to me must be very happy. But the day I proposed to Janine, it didn't work out at all like I planned it. So we knew we were going to get married. We went and we chose the ring and all those type of things. I mean, we were so poor back then. I was considering buying a lucky packet for the ring. But we managed to get a ring. And shame, we married now 17 years. When we were married for 20 years, I'm going to buy my wife a proper ring. You know, one that reflects the magnitude of my affection for her. But the night I proposed to her, and we knew, we'd been talking about it, and she knew it was going to come. We had some family gathering at her parents' place, where she was still living at the time, of course, and her dad asked me to chop wood and get anthracite and coal from the garage and all. So I had all this, and I walked in, and Janine was leading me to the place where I was supposed to get the stuff. And I was planning to propose that night. And I knew she was expecting. I thought, she wouldn't be expecting it now. Let me do it right now while I'm covered in black coal and anthracite. And so she walked in front of me. Then she turned around and she saw this blackened coal hands standing with a ring light. And I just said, will you marry me? She was so shocked. She said, yes. She couldn't change her mind. And here we are today. The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that imagine I proposed to her that night. Now, we obviously built a relationship. She knew how I felt about her. I kind of figured the first date that we went on, I took her to Tiger Valley, and we sat there in the food court. And this was just like the first exploratory date. And she goes on the table. So, Mr. Cornelius, what are your plans with me? Like, I just shot back and thinking, whoa, let's take it easy, right? But the reality, and my response was true. I said, listen, I can't remember, I was in my 20s. I'm a theological graduate planting a church. I don't have time to mess around. If I'm here with you, I think there's potential for a long-lasting relationship, hopefully marriage. And that's how it ended up. But imagine she said, so Mr. Cornelius, what are your plans with me? And I said, you know what? I'm burning right now. And all I need is a sexual partner. So let's get married. Do you think that would have endeared her to me? So I want you to understand that your sexuality does not set the agenda for the rest of your life. That is exactly why the disciples who soon to become apostles understood from Matthew 19 when they said, but if this is the case of marriage, if marriage is of such value and the boundaries are so distinct, it's better not to get married. At that point, the lights go off and they understand that there are certain other facilities and actions and visions in life which are more important than sexuality, that then I'd rather not, I would sacrifice that because I don't want that. Not only is God more interested in your pleasure, sexuality is not supposed to set the agenda for all of your life. Jesus is. Now, the Catholic Church understands this well. And they said, if you can overcome your sexual appetite, you can become a priest. Because we want you to not only worship Jesus, in their dogma, we want you to be married to Him. We want you to serve Him and Him alone. Now, it does come with certain consequences sometimes. Sometimes it is a bit unnatural, but I think they're right in their basic understanding that your sexuality does not have to define every aspect of your life. You will not die. For those of you who are addicted to pornography, I want you to know, John Piper uses this example. He says that if ISIS should break into this church right now and put a gun to your head and then tell you, listen, I'm going to kill you unless you never watch pornography again, you won't watch it again. You are giving your sexuality too much power. It is being fueled by a culture that is drunk on sexuality, and you have bought into that lie. Trust in Jesus, and in the right circumstances, you are able to set yourself free by God's grace. So that's the two overarching principles. Let me give you the rest of a biblical survey as to sexuality. Sex. The first one is this, that sex is supposed to be intimate, it's not supposed to be incompatible. So what I mean by this is God gives married people, couples, the gift of sex so that the bond and the relationship between them can make them one flesh and closer. It's a blessing. It's supposed to consummate the intimacy that is there affectionately and emotionally. When I say it's supposed to be intimate and not incompatible, I'm not talking about whether you are sexually compatible with one another. You know, this is supposed to be compatible in that way. You grow in that compatibility. But what I mean is, any system that does not exercise or make room to exercise the sexuality of humanity in a godly, healthy way, is an incompatible system. And you do not buy into that system. You don't validate that system, and you don't participate in that system. The second one is, it's an investment, and it's not supposed to be invasive. So, we are facing a crisis in South Africa, where sexuality has gone rampant, because we think it's a right, and we're entitled to it, and so men just take it from women. It's called rape. And sexual crime is a major issue in Africa, not just South Africa. But I want you to understand, God never intended it to be that way. And even between a man and his wife, or vice versa, you give yourself, you don't take it as the partner. It's not supposed to be invasive, but it is an investment. And when I say investment, I mean it's something that, again, builds the intimacy, builds the closeness. But it is something, brothers and sisters, that you are never supposed to use as a weapon. So wives, husbands, never use your sexual intimacy against your spouse. Never say, well, I'm going to punish you. You don't see me in a month. Next time you see me is a month's time. You're shooting yourself in the foot because in a month's time you still have to be married to that grumpy old guy. And now he's more grumpy. It's an investment. It's not a strategy. It's not supposed to be invasive, but it's an investment. And third, it's indulgent versus intolerant. So in other words, you have to indulge in it. Andreas Kosterberger, who I like very much, wrote a book called God, Marriage, and Family. And there's a new edition coming out next year. The third edition. And he says this about marriage and sexuality. He says that you have got to indulge your partner, not only just on the sake of an investment. An investment means, I don't really want to do this, but let me do it because I understand what it does for us. But you've got to indulge in it. And you've got to find a joy in it. You've got to submit yourself to the great blessing that God has given you. Don't pass on it. Don't be intolerant of it. I love you. I just don't like being physical with you. And then he says this, that marriage is the only context in which your sexuality can be expressed. So express it. Indulge. And to all the married couples here today, now we are on various levels in life. We all have our own rhythm. But I do want to say, we have the chance to indulge and enjoy. Do so. Now let's move on. Why do we do what we do? Let's go to Hebrews 12 very quickly. Let's look at verse 15. It says, see to it that no one misses the grace of God and that no bitter root grows up to cause trouble and defile many. Now that's a general statement in church dynamics and relationships that the author here is referring to, but let me apply it to your sexuality. See to it that in your marriage, that in the expression of your sexuality or the non-expression thereof, that there are no bitter roots that develop in that relationship. Hence, Paul writes in another epistle and he says, listen, your body does not belong to yourself. The day that you got married, you said, all of this is yours. And then he says, in relation to fasting and sexuality, he says, don't deny each other the privilege, the joy, the benefit of sexuality with one another, intimacy with one another, except when you are going through the spiritual discipline of fasting, and then only for a short period at a time. Why? Because he understood this is a great investment in your relationship. So don't let a bitter root develop in your marriage because of sexuality or the lack thereof. So two principles here. Bring no foreign thing into your marriage. No foreign thing. Secondly, do not remove something like the expression of sexuality simply because you don't feel like it most oftentimes. See to it that no one misses the grace of God, that no bitter root grows up to cause trouble and defile many. And see that no one is sexually immoral or is godless like Esau. Let me park out here for a moment. I'm going to give you three D's very quickly. I've given you three I's, which is it's intimate, it's an investment, and it's indulgent. It's a place to be indulgent. The three D's are this: desire, drive, and deed. Why do we do what we do? You see, Esau was out living life. And in the course of living life, he expends energy. That energy needs to be replenished. We all have various ways of doing it. After a hard day's work, you might be one of those people that likes to vegetate in front of the TV. After a hard day's work, you might want to go and sit and have a beer. After a hard day's work, you might want to be intimate with your spouse. Everybody's got a different rhythm and a different way of cooling down. But there's a desire because of spent energy. And what the author of Hebrews is telling us over here, he says, listen, see to it that you remove nothing from your marriage. Don't remove the sexual intimacy aspect. You might not be wired quite the same as your spouse, but don't deny them. If you do, that energy to replenish, to recharge, you might begin to look elsewhere. The desire that you have, you might want to fulfill in another unholy context. Don't do that. Secondly, not only is the desire as a result of spent energy, there could be a desire as a result of fallen energy. We call it drive. You've got this drive that is pushing you to do things you know that are not from God. And I want to ask you that if that is something that rests in your soul, that haunts your mind and informs your actions, I'd like to pray for you. That is a demonic facility to push you away from God and make you do certain things. I was reading a few months ago the transcripts of some of the criminal cases around sexuality here in South Africa. And I forget the gentleman's name, but he was out in Pretoria. He is South Africa's most notable serial rapist and killer. I forget the guy's name. He wasn't from South Africa. He was from another nation north of us. He escaped from prison numerous times. He's in prison today. And I read some of the transcripts, and he said, he can't explain it, but there is a drive and a voice that enters into his mind where he has no option but to rape and to kill. If you have got a drive that pushes you towards pornography, a drive that pushes you towards sex with prostitutes, a drive that pushes you to practice your sexuality outside of the biblical boundaries, there's hope for you. His name is Jesus. For he who the Son sets free is free indeed. And the last D is deed. You don't want to do something in the context of Hebrews 12 and Jacob and Esau that sets the agenda for your future present based on your bad decision-making today. Young ladies, there's always going to be a young man that's going to want to get you into bed today without putting a ring on that finger, without committing to you for a lifetime. Be careful. The consequences could set the agenda for the rest of your life. Young man, you don't get off quite the same yourself. You practice against what God has advised us and commanded us in His Word. And I want to tell you, you will bear the spiritual and sometimes the physical and financial consequences of those actions. Let me conclude very quickly. So sex, in very broad terms, God is interested in it more than you. You don't have to have sex to be a full human being. That's a lie. It's supposed to be intimate. It's supposed to be an investment. And it's supposed to be indulgent within marriage. Go for it. Enjoy it. Do it as often as you can with your spouse. Why do we then do what we do? We expend energy and therefore we have the desire to recharge. Relational recharging within marriage is the practice of your sexuality. There's desire. That desire can sometimes be fallen. Don't deny each other. That drive that comes from desire can also be fallen. Be careful that their drives are informed by demonic thinking and practice. And indeed, make sure that what you are doing is in the spirit and ethic of God. Now I call upon you in the ethic of the table to reflect, to repent, and to be restored. Your sexuality is a gift from God. Very often we have twisted and turned it into something which is dark and ugly. But I tell you today, there is hope in Jesus Christ.